AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
They've got a face like a bag of chisels, Bill McLaren's immortal description of a particular French international front row in the 1970s. These days, with cameras everywhere together with TMOs and sighting officers, the beasts that were the hard men of French rugby are now virtually extinct. But at these time, at certain times in rugby history, these men, some of them seemingly hewn from the rocks of the Pyrenees, were brutal both on and off the field. It's going to be the subject of a new book called The Hard Men of French Rugby, I believe. It's written by rugby journalist and all around good chap, Mike Pearce. I've been looking forward to speaking to Mike for about a week now. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK. Mike Pearce. Mike, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Buenos dias, or if I use the language of heaven, pranhaun da.
Ah. Now, you've got a Spanish connection because you write for a Spanish rugby site, don't you, if I remember correctly?
I do, yeah. There was a magazine called Revista 8,
yeah,
which brought out a few issues. And I've got my daughter lives in Barcelona, so there is a bit of a Spanish connection, certainly.
I was kind of wondering, because you first crossed my radar, Mike, because of your writing on Spanish rugby. Now then, this is an amazing subject, and I'm glad that somebody's finally taken the fromage by the horns and decided to put this down in a book, because French rugby players are one of the great mysteries of the universe. And during the 70s, the hard men of French rugby, the 70s, the 80s into the 90s, the hard men of the French rugby scene were quite something.
Oh, they certainly were. And, I mean, I met my publisher, Ashley Drake, who works for St. David's Press, just before the France-Wales game this year in Cardiff. And we had a chat, and we realised there's not one English language book of this nature. So he said, go away and do some research. And, you know, some of the stuff I found is just eye-watering. But as you say, in the 70s, you know, my love of rugby started in the 70s being Welsh. And, of course, there was only one country I was interested in, you know, seduced by Grand Slams, you know. And the players we had, you know, we didn't use their surnames. We just used their initials, JJ, JPR. But then one day, I don't know when this happened, but I noticed there was another rugby world, you know, a world that sort of encompassed beauty and brutality, but it also had some sort of elegance and beauty. And, of course, this was French rugby. And the other thing was this game was played in sunshine, which was a very rare commodity where I came from. And its backs, you know, they were stylish. They played with their collars turned up. They had wonderful angles of running. You know, they did things with the ball that I'd never seen before. And, you know, as a teenager riddled with acne, these guys were so good looking. You know, they looked more like film stars than rugby players.
And it's, I mean, that's the beauty of like, you know, I mean, I grew up watching sort of Serge Blanco and that sort of lot.
Yeah.
And you're talking about, yeah. Yeah. But that's the grace of France. That's the, you know, the flair of France. That's the living the romantic dream of French rugby. But the front row, the forwards, yeah, absolute rock apes. I mean, especially in the 70s. I mean, you know, the tales that you hear of, you know, the French front row butting the walls, you know, knocking tiles off with their heads before going into heure de combat, goes before it. Just looking through some of them, you know, some of them, especially in that gold, I mean, you can always say there's always a golden age of sport, and it seems to be the 60s and the 70s before everything became too commercial. But the, you know, obviously you have the Wales team of the 70s, England are nowhere to be seen, basically, and then you have the French team of complete rock apes.
Yeah, these guys were incredible. I mean, Pascal Ondarts, you know, a Basque gentleman. He was a blacksmith in Bayonne. And when you see this guy, he literally looks like he's swallowed the anvil. I mean, he's that sort of shape, you know. And on his debut in 1986, France played the All Blacks in Nantes, which is regarded as one of the, you know, roughest games of all time. And if I tell you Wayne Shelford, I'm sure a lot of people know the famous All Black.
Yeah.
I hope nobody's eating, but he found himself at the bottom of a ruck and a French boot tore open his scrotum, leaving a testicle hanging out. Now, you know, the All Blacks are hard characters. Shelford had it stitched up on the touchline, and the whole thing was shown live on French television. and he returned to be knocked out cold and have seven teeth knocked out. So I think that gives you an idea of the nature of you know, French rugby at that time.
And also the other thing about the rugby is the areas in which it played. I mean, everybody knows sort of Racing and all those areas, but it is, you know, you mentioned that they look like they've been hewn out the very stone of the Pyrenees. I mean, the Basque influence in French rugby is quite huge.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they've had some cracking players, as I say, Pascal Ondarts, and there was a guy called Pierre D'Hospital who
that's a good name, D'Hospital, isn't it?
I was just going to say that, you know, it's just an H missing, and it was very apt. You know, yeah, as you say, the south of France particularly, and of course a lot of these players had agricultural backgrounds, so they were strong, you know, naturally through the work they did. A bit like the Welsh team in the 70s, who had steel workers and coal miners. You know, they weren't gym monkeys; they were just naturally hard through the work they did, and it showed in their play. And, you know, as you say, team, you know, when I was a kid, I, you know, going to London was unheard of. That was like Mars. So the thought of somebody going to France was, you know, just incredible. And I used to get the program sent to me from the French games, and you'd read the little pen pictures, and they'd mention these towns, Mont-de-Marsan, La Volte, you know, and Brive-la-Gaillarde, and they just sounded so romantic, you know. And of course, as I say, I never, you know, I was a kid, I never thought I'd venture to these places. And of course, when you go and play these teams, there's an old saying about you never lose a match within the sound of your own church bells. It doesn't matter if you lose an away game, but, you know, it's village pride. For example, Brive-la-Gaillarde, you know, when you play the team, you don't just play the team, you play the town, its history, its culture, you know, so it really is open warfare.
I mean,
go on.
I mean, the other thing is the fact that, you know, you've got all this hardman exterior, but they do have a tendency to become a little bit emotional and a little bit carried away, and it can sometimes get the better of them, these French hardmen of rugby. I mean, I remember watching the quarterfinal in 91, England-France, and I knew by the weeping front row, you know, that was as Le Marzalet, and it was played at the Parc de France, not Stade France.
Yeah.
And we were watching it in a certain establishment, and I thought, we've got them, because they were so carried away and so hyped up with the whole thing that you knew that the discipline was completely shot. And thus it came to pass that I think it was I'm trying to remember who knocked out Simon Hadley in the first like 5 minutes or something, and then we had the famous Mickey Skinner and Le Tackle.
That's right, and Session. Yeah,
Session.
Session's an interesting character. He features in the book, and he had an awful lot of trouble when he retired from the game. He resorted to alcohol, he suffered from depression, and he turned up one evening to a barbecue and shot and killed his wife. You know, so it's a tragic tale, really. You know, a guy who, when he gave up the game, had no direction, and, you know, his life basically fell apart. But yeah, going back to the French game, I think it was Brian Moore who was the expert at winding the French up. You know, and England did have this knack, didn't they, of, you know, getting to the emotional side of the French, and they, as you rightly say, you could see in their eyes they were just going to fall apart.
Also, just going back to that thing about Session, he's not the first French player to have, or at least Harman to have, troubles. There was the case of Armand Vakirian, was it Vakirian?
Yeah, absolutely, in Béziers, yeah. The Russian roulette, he took a revolver out, and the story is still very muddled, and people in Béziers are very reluctant to talk about it, but the story is that he was wanted to play Russian roulette, nobody would play. He thought the gun was empty, so he pointed it to his head, pulled the trigger, and of course there was a bullet in the chamber, and bless him, he was no more.
Another thing that I always remember are the, perhaps you could say that it was during the, I mean, the 70s was thuggery, and you know, they were hard men, and they, like I said, they were blacksmiths, they were seemingly cast from stone. As the 80s sort of wore on, and we got shamateurism, and then we came into the 90s and the professional game, you remember shamateurism, we started to get some real characters. There was Olivier Merle, who I remember playing, watching him play, and he was known as, what was it, Le Massif Central?
That's right, yeah, absolutely massive guy. And of course, he broke Welsh prop Ricky Evans's ankle, and it was one of the first cases at the time where he was sued for damages for an injury occurred, and he never played for France again. But as you rightly say, he was, one, even by French standards, he was scary.
And also there was Laurent Saunier, was it Saunier, who, this is a wonderful story, about, he punched somebody, but he punched somebody, punched somebody on his own side. Just explain what happened.
Well, yeah, I think it was Gregor Townsend, the Scottish coach, was fly half a breve at the time, and he turned up, and it was a very laid-back character, and he said, they were punching the walls, they were punching each other, by the time they walked, actually walking out of the pitch for kickoff was blood pouring down their heads. It's just crazy, absolutely crazy.
And he once famously, he once punched a teammate for running too slow.
It's incredible. If you look at some of these incidents on YouTube, it's quite scary. And of course, it seems to be the referees didn't have an awful lot of control in those days. I mean, going back to Gerard Sholley, the big prop, on one game against Scotland in 1977, I think he knocked out two or three people. Two were carried off on stretchers, and you see the referee just wagging his finger, and carrying on. No, of course, there were no cards in those days, but there were, no red cards, no sending off, no warnings. It all seemed to be, the way of the world in those days.
I can't not mention a man who has become a legend in Pontypridd, I think, Philippe Carbonneau. There were two things, because there's this thing about this hard man from the hardest man who used to fight everybody, but then B, what happened to him when he met a certain lightweight Wales rugby player. But just, I mean, he's infamous at Pontypridd, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it goes back to a European Cup game where Pontypridd visited Brive.
That's a word for it.
Brive did not lose at home, and they expected people to kowtow to them. Well, anybody who knows the Pontypridd team will realise that they picked the wrong people to try and intimidate. I mean, they weren't known as the Valley Commandos for nothing, but they turned up, and they wouldn't let Pontypridd get away with it, and they gave us as good as they got. And of course, the legend and the true story is that afterwards they all went to Bar La Toulzac in Brie for a few drinks, and it all kicked off. It was like the Wild West in there. The police were involved. There was arrests. There were injuries, and of course they had to play the return match in Pontypridd the week later. So, but Carbonneau was a nasty piece of work. I mean, he would instigate, typical scrum half. he'd get involved. And his headbutt was his weapon of choice. But going back to the you said about getting his comeuppance. Now, anybody who's heard of Arwell Thomas, he was probably one of the smallest and lightest fly halves ever to play for Wales. And when Wales faced France at the Parc des Princes, Arul Thomas took a swing at him and knocked him out cold. And I don't think Carbonell's reputation ever recovered from that.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, you think, especially with Carbonell, who's, you know, a very interesting case, but you know, it's always been the thing with rugby is it stays on the field. And then afterwards, you know, unless you're a complete, you know, idiot, you know, I mean, you know, I was a very bad rugby player. But the thing was, at the end of the day, you absolutely bought your opposite number a drink.
Yeah. I mean, these Pontypridd guys, the ground where they used to play in Pontypridd, Sardis Road, was known as the House of Pain. They really didn't take any prisoners. But from what I know, I've spoken to people about this, and it does seem to be the French that wound things up in the bar. And of course, you know, it didn't take much for the fires to be lit. And but it's thank goodness it happened, because it's given me a pretty good chapter.
Yeah, that's good. The other thing I was going to say though is, you know, in this age of TMCs and, you know, global games and the World Cups being played, I mean, there are still throwbacks. I mean, Ntamack and Serge Besson and you know, the Beast and Chabal, who is just, you know, yeah. I mean, yeah. The caveman is. I mean, yeah. I've got a when it's working, I've got a huge Toyota Land Cruiser which is jacked up, and it's got all. It's massive. It seats about 800 people, and it's blue, obviously, and it's called Chabal, because it's just, you know, because he was a throwback to another age of rugby, if not another age of man's development.
Absolutely, but you know, he's such a contradiction, because when you meet him in person, he's like a big teddy bear. You know, he's so gentle and soft. I mean, I remember when France were awarded the World Cup. They made an announcement in the London hotel, and Chabal was there as part of the French delegation. And he was sat on stage. He had Jonah Lomu's young kids on his lap, and he was tickling them and playing with them. You know, such a contradiction to the guy on the pitch. And of course, you know, he loves sending himself up. He's done adverts dressed as a fairy, as a chambermaid, you know, so he's very much a contradiction, but yeah, a pretty hard character.
So, I mean, how did you come then to writing this book? I mean, who did you interview some of the ex-players, people who played against them? Did you track down, did you head off into the Pyrenees with your holy relic and your silver bullet to try and track down some of these, let's face it, complete psychos of the French game?
Well, the last couple of years, I'm a freelance journalist, and so struggling freelance journalist, and a lot of my work has involved the French internationals and the top 14 games. So, as I've gone around, I did an interview with the former French captain Guillaume Girardot.
Okay, yeah.
And it all sort of stemmed from that. Now, that's an interesting story for Spanish people, because his grandparents fled Granada. During Franco's reign, and they walked through Spain, crossed the Pyrenees by foot, and settled in the south of France. But he's a guy who sort of opened a few doors for me and got me in touch with, you know, people like Philippe Seller and also got Serge Betson, of course. And you're talking about hard guys. There's a guy, he's had 200 stitches in his face and neck alone.
Jeez.
Throughout his career. So, you know, and this book, we were just going to do a book about hard men of French rugby, and then Ashley, the publisher, said, why don't you see if you can get an actual team together, you know, 1 to 15, 15 chapters. So so that's what we've done. We've got Jean-Pierre Rive in there, Mathieu Bastereau, Emil Ntamack, Scholli, on darts, you know, so it covers quite a range. It's not just the rough guys, it's some of the flair merchants as well.
Yeah, indeed. Must have been tremendous fun picking out your team then, of 15 French hard rugby players.
Yeah, there's plenty of choice, that's for sure. And, you know, I went for the ones with the more interesting sort of stories and backstories, you know, for Session, etc., you know, with his murder conviction. And Philip Carboneau, because mainly because of the Pontypridd connection.
Yeah.
But, you know, with people like Philippe Seller, obviously an absolute legend of the game, and Reeve, you know, another one that would walk into any World 15, I think. Yeah, so it's still ongoing. They want to bring it out in 2022, before the Rugby World Cup in France. So plenty of time to tweak it, and it's a thoroughly enjoyable process, I must say. Particularly, you know, sadly during this COVID period where I'm not at work, and it's given me.
Oh, hello, Mike. We're losing you there. Hello, Mike. Seems like his connection's been trampled by a French back row. Mike? And as my Welsh grandmother used to say, and there he was gone. I'll try and get him back after this.
I think you think. I'm John Harper. I'm here to get behind the censorship, find out what's really happening, and what it is that they don't want you to hear.
I'm Giles Brown, and I'm here to be the voice of reason.
We're here with you every Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m.
I think you think.
Be with us, because what you think is what we want to hear.
I think you think.
Presented by John Harper and Giles Brown.
Starts Wednesday at 8 p.m.
You're listening to Talk Radio Europe.
Pliers.
Pliers.
Pipe wrench.
Pipe wrench.
Screwdriver.
Screwdriver.
Hose cutter.
Oh, bucket. Mop. Umbrella.
Hello, I need an emergency plumber, please.
Home insurance from Linea Directa starts from just €98 and comes with I'm No Plumber coverage. Thank goodness. Don't call your husband. Call Linea Directa on 902 123 616. That's 902 123 616. T's and C's apply.
Everybody's got their own lockdown story, and we want to hear yours. Tell us your experiences, the highs and the lows, the good and the bad, personal stories or business ones. Outline your lockdown story in less than 100 words and send it to wendy@tre.radio. Please remember to put lockdown stories in the subject bar and include your phone number. It's your chance to share your story with me and the listeners live on air in the coming weeks. Businesses, please get involved, because the best business lockdown story will win a free one-month advertising campaign right here on TRE.
It's GB, not GQ.
Presented by Giles Brown.
So I do want to thank you for making our lives a lot less, more enjoyable.
You see, there I was in full flow, and obviously the phone line got trampled by an errant flanker.
I knew I should have paid the phone bill this month.
Well, you know, it's all that broadband you've been in and putting the research
there.
Times
are hard, Giles.
So do you think, I mean, hopefully, I mean, so we're looking at the book coming out in, because you've got a Twitter site I've been watching. Was there a sort of film based, or was it a short film thing based around it as well?
Yeah, it's just my own little sort of cobble together, you know, with so much time on my hands, getting some apps, you know, from Apple Store or whatever it is. So yeah, just some bits and pieces to, you know, try and entertain. As I say, I have set up a Twitter account at French Rugby Hard Men, just to keep people informed and post. You know, I've come across some lovely old photographs and some great quotes. So I'm just putting stuff on daily. You know, so if anybody wants to have a look, and of course, you know, as the time gets nearer, there'll be. There'll be more details about the book.
Yeah, I mean, I had a quick flick through, and Serge Blanco, I didn't recognise him now, but he's certainly, isn't he? He's certainly put on a few pounds. But there's, You know, I mean, he makes Ronaldo look like Twiggy. I mean, you know.
I think as well what happened, when he played, he used to smoke 40 cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
And once he gave up smoking, he obviously switched to... croissants or something.
Pain au chocolat. But the other thing, see, the thing about Blanco, though, as well, because he wasn't exactly squeaky clean, was he? I mean, I remember watching Blanco play and just going, little person, you know?
Yeah, he was. I think he was one of the first to sort of start the play acting a bit as well, and I think that used to wind people up. But you know, a marvellous, marvellous player.
Yeah. There's a wonderful quote as well from Jean-Paul Reeve, who you wouldn't expect that, because he used to strike fear into everybody. But he said the whole point, and I love this, because, I mean, rugby is a game like no other. And it says the whole point of rugby is that it is, first and foremost, a state of mind, a spirit. That's just marvellous.
He's a, and, you know, he was another lovely character. And apparently when he had a bad game and he signed autographs, he'd sign his surname with a small R.
Okay.
It's just a, you know, a quirky little thing, but I think that sort of sums him up perfectly. You know, it's a great guy. Hasn't kept any of his souvenirs, given all his jerseys and trophies, everything away. You know, real sort of throwback to, you know, the real amateur days, I guess.
Yeah. So which one of the, as you're putting this book together, which is your hardest of the hard Frenchmen, do you think, thus far?
Scholly, I reckon. Gerard Scholly. Because, you know, the guy was just an animal. He was a paratrooper during his national service, and I think it was Fran Cotton who said he used to go up the line out and knock people out like a bus conductor collecting fares. And another French player said, when I saw him walking out the tunnel, he looked like Moby Dick in a goldfish bowl. That's another perfect description of the guy, you know. It's, yeah, he'd be my, you know, they're all pretty scary, but he's the one I'd have nightmares about for sure.
The book is going to be called French Rugby Hard Men, but like I said, you can go online, you can go find out on Twitter what the progression of the book. But we're looking, it's going to be out with St. David's Press, yeah?
That's right, yeah, it's a Welsh publisher, and hopefully everything will go to plan.
And hopefully we'll have some rugby sooner rather than later, because in this age of no, you know, 5-6 feet apart, it's absolutely, you know, I mean, what are your thoughts at the moment?
It's tough, isn't it? Because rugby is probably the hardest sport to make sure there's social distancing, and I know there's talk of, you know, banning scrums and lineouts, etc. But personally, I would rather wait till the game can come back in its you know, unadulterated form, rather than try and mess about with it. Hopefully things will improve and we can get to a stage where at least, you know, we can get some internationals or club games going behind closed doors, at least.
I tell you what my thing, what my solution is, though. And you're going to like this, yeah? They can come back and play, okay? No problem. But, you know, I started watching rugby. I mean, you know, my mother was from Glasgow, my father's from Treorchy, and I'm born in England. Do you know how hellish my Five Nations was as a kid? And exactly, right? So one of my earliest memories is my Welsh grandfather calling me from the Arms Park, from a phone box, because we'd lost to, you know, England had lost to Wales again, and he was belittling me, and I was about, I don't know, probably about six at the time. But, but at that time, when you go back and you watch, you know, that game, Barbers, New Zealand, etc., or any of those matches, rugby is a game, and I have always said this, for all levels, for all shapes and all sizes. And if you look at stuff from the 70s, and to a certain extent the 80s, Will Carling stand up, it can be only, you know, shape of, and they look, you know, you can tell the props because they look like they just come off a building site, and the backs are just, you know, practicing their ballet moves. So my thought is, we'll go back to rugby, but nobody's allowed to train for the first couple of weeks, because they'll all have been off for about 5 weeks, you know, for about four. So some of them will be fit, and some of them will be just puffing around the place looking like looking like Serge Blanco now. How's that?
Yeah, that sounds a brilliant idea. Yeah, I'll back that one.
That's brilliant. Listen, Mike, it's been brilliant to speak to you. Looking forward to seeing the book coming up sooner rather than later. If people want to get in contact with you, just give them all the details about where they can find you.
Yeah, sure. It's I've got a Twitter site at MP Sports Dragon, and a website, www.thesportsdragon.com. But if you're solely interested in the book, it's the French Rugby Hard Men Twitter site. And hopefully you'll find all you need to know on there.
Well, good. It's been great to speak to you finally. Good luck with the book. And hopefully we'll get some of the game happening soon as well. Mike Pearce, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Giles. Thank you.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.